Welcome to ACT Radio, Animal Concerns of Texas. I'm Greg Lawson.
And I'm Tom Linney.
Here on ACT, we talk about how we humans relate to other animals.
We talk about how we use them for food, clothing, and entertainment, and how there are humane alternatives to these practices.
We also talk about how a plant-based diet is not only best for human health, but the best thing one can do for the environment.
So if you're concerned about the environment, if you're concerned about the way animals are treated, if you're concerned about your health, stay with us for Animal Concerns of Texas. Coming up on today's show, we feature a conversation with Leinana Two Moons. She's the author of the cookbook Baconish. That's a little later in the show, but first some news.
AFIS, the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, is a branch of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. It's been their duty to inspect and report on laboratories that test on animals, zoos, circuses, and breeders of dogs, horses, and other animals. Earlier this month, the U.S. Department of Agriculture removed all animal welfare reports from its website. They removed animal welfare inspection reports, enforcement records, and other information about the treatment of animals. A spokesperson for the USDA's Animal, Plant, and Health Inspection Service would not say if the removal was temporary or permanent in the new Trump administration. The information has long been used by advocacy groups and other members of the public to look up information on commercial dog and horse breeders, some of whom have had a history of abuse. The reports included lists of animal welfare violations at facilities that use animals and whether those violations have been corrected. In place of the online database is a new message from the department saying that it's implementing actions to remove documents related to the Animal Welfare Act and the Horse Protection Act. In doublespeak language that seems to be typical of the new federal government, the USDA website message said that the records have been removed based on our commitment to being transparent and remaining responsive to our stakeholders' informational needs. Justin Goodman, vice president of the White Coast Waste Project, an organization that advocates for animals in testing labs, said, "There was already, before today, a disturbing lack of transparency in how animals are used." The USDA statement said that the animal welfare documents will still be available through Freedom of Information Act requests, which can be costly for the general public and sometimes take months or years to obtain. Advocacy groups said that the lack of documentation of violations would immediately affect their work. Animal welfare organizations have condemned the removal of the information, which they called unexpected, and said would allow animal abuse to go unchecked. John Goodwin, who runs the Stop Puppy Mills campaign at the Humane Society of the United States, said, "What the USDA has done is given cover to people who neglect or harm animals and get cited by USDA inspectors. The public is no longer going to know which commercial dog breeders, horse trainers, which zoos, which research labs have horrible animal welfare track records." Members of the public could also use the department's online database to search for information about dog breeders, as could pet stores. Seven states currently require pet stores to source puppies from breeders with clean USDA inspection records, according to the Humane Society of the United States, a requirement that could now be impossible to meet. In a statement, Kathy Guillermo, a senior vice president for People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, called it a shameful attempt to keep the public from knowing when and which laws and regulations have been violated. Removal of these animal welfare reports from the USDA website was greeted with appreciation by people in businesses that use animals, including agriculture and exotic pet breeders, who have long resented government oversight that they say is overly aggressive and influenced by animal protection groups.
From One Green Planet, we're sure you've all heard about the horrid sport in South Africa known to some as canned lion hunting, but to most as straight-up murder. But just in case you've forgotten, here's a quick overview of the gory details before we get to the skeletons. Trophy hunting is big business in Africa, and wealthy patrons like Eric and Donald Trump Jr. will pay up to $70,000 to feel like men and kill innocent animals. But even trophy hunters have to cringe a bit when it comes to canned lion hunting, and here's why. Canned lions are bred to trust humans. Further, in a canned hunting venue, the hunter is essentially designated to an enclosure where the animal has no chance of escape. Essentially, it's like shooting fish in a barrel, except with one of the world's fiercest but most endangered species. Lions were put on the endangered species list in 2015 because their wild population had dwindled from 200,000 to just 20,000 over the course of the last century. So while lion breeding programs may be needed to revitalize the wild populations, in South Africa, they're breeding lions for a different purpose, hunting and tourism. There are an estimated 200 lion breeding farms in South Africa that are responsible for the trade of 6,000 to 8,000 captive big cats. The lion cubs are sold into the exotic pet industry or used as selfie props in petting zoos. So these animals have grown up around people. They're used to being pet by humans, not fear them. But upon reaching maturity, these cubs are no longer cute enough to be of value to a petting zoo, and so their lives are sold to the highest bidder, someone with a gun who wants to take a picture with a dead animal. While some of these lion farms attempt to hide as legitimate conservation facilities, it has been well documented that no legitimate ecologist would introduce these farm lions into the wild because they have been so interbred, it would be a genetic disaster. In a macabre twist to the grisly story, South Africa has announced their intention to export 800 lion skeletons to Vietnam and Laos, where they are used in traditional Eastern medicine. The problem is that lion hunting is legal in South Africa, and by creating space in the legal world for this cruel industry means that it will continue to thrive and prosper. Despite significant pressure from conservation organizations around the globe, the South African government does not appear to be making any policy changes in the near future. However, the reduction of skeletons to be exported could be an indication that South Africa is going to start moving away from the slaughter and sale of lions. If you would like to fight for the illegalization of lion hunting, you can do so by visiting a petition at onegreenplanet.org. Stay with us. Coming up next is a conversation with Lenana Two Moons. She's the author of the cookbook Baconish, sultry and smoky plant-based recipes from BLTs to bacon to mac and cheese. She's also the author of the blog Vegan Good Things, where she shares her enthusiasm for all things good and vegan. That's next on ACT Radio. Joining us now on Animal Concerns of Texas is Lenana Two Moons. Thanks for being with us, Lenana.
Hi, happy to be here.
We like to ask our guests what led them to veganism. So could you tell us your story?
Sure, I'd be happy to. What led me to veganism, I have to say, mostly is that I married a longtime vegan.
That works, yeah.
Yeah. You know, when I met my now husband, he had already been a vegan for many, many, many years. And, you know, he's been vegan since before, long before it was cool to be vegan. So, you know, we met at the time. When we met, I was definitely not vegan. I still ate seafood, fish and seafood, and I ate dairy and eggs, but I didn't eat other kinds of meat. I hadn't eaten, you know, cows or pigs for a long time, but I definitely was not vegan yet. And then, you know, it was just we were together, and he never, ever, ever pushed veganism on me. He didn't try to convert me ever, but you know, we were living together, and I'm the only one who cooks at home. So,
oh, yeah.
You know, I'm the only one who cooks. He doesn't cook. So, you know, so at home I would cook only vegan food just, you know, to make it easier. And I was fine eating vegan at home. But, you know, if we would go out to eat, I might still order, you know, if we'd go out to brunch, I'd get eggs or whatever. But, you know, I really started falling in love with cooking vegan. And, you know, even when we would go out to eat, if I would order something not vegan, I always ended up enjoying his food more than mine. You know, I would get food envy. It's like, I wanted what he had instead. And so, you know, it was sort of not super conscious, but more and more and more I was eating a plant-based diet. And at some point along the way, I started to realize that my health issues I had really as long as I could remember my whole life were disappearing. And I was feeling so much better. And especially when I cut out the dairy, I felt so much better. And it was a very clear link to the changes in my diet. My diet kind of transitioned first, and then it was health reasons that, you know, I was seeing the bonus from that. And then I would say, you know, it was one night we were home and I happened to watch the movie Earthling.
Oh, Lord.
And that sealed the deal.
Yeah.
After, you know, I think a lot of people had that experience after watching Earthlings. After I saw that, that was when I said, okay, it's not just food, and I'm not buying any more leather, any more animal products of any kind. And from that point on, I called myself vegan.
I have a copy of Earthlings that sat on my counter for years. I watched a few minutes of it, but I couldn't take it very much.
Movies, it is intense, yeah.
Yeah, movies have been a great motivation for many people.
Yeah.
I'm curious, since we don't really, you know, we don't really talk about the movie much on the show. We kind of just,
right.
A lot of people mention it as something that impacts them or was part of their path. But without being too graphic, was there a particular part in the show that, you know, really helped you move away from eating fish? Because I know that's especially now as the Lent season's coming up, people are switching to fish. And I'm just curious if there was something that.
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, now looking back, it doesn't make any sense to me now. But, you know, at the time, I felt like, oh, well, fish are okay. It's more, you know, it's a healthy kind of meat. And you don't really tend to think of fish as being as sentient as other animals. You know, they're not furry and cute and cuddly. And you know, also for me, I will also say there was a cultural factor because I'm half Thai. So, you know, the Thai side of my family, like my mother grew up, my Thai family, they live on a beach, like on the coastal part of Thailand, and they eat a lot of seafood. It's a very natural part of their diet. And so, you know, there was the cultural issues with me, too, where I loved Thai food. I loved seafood. It was the kind of food that my mother liked to cook. And so it also had that emotional component
right.
for me. But then, you know, as you mentioned, when I watched Earthlings, it was really the first view I'd seen of, you know, the fish like actually suffering and feeling. And you kind of tend to have this sort of romantic idea of like, oh, you know, somebody out in a boat catching fish, little fish. But these are enormous, like fish as big as human beings.
Yeah.
And with, you know, the nervous systems, and they feel pain and they experience, you know, fear and terror too. And that really, really resonated with me. And I thought like, well, okay, absolutely not. You know, the movie also touched upon all the environmental destruction from the fishing industry,
right.
Which ethically you that's a huge, huge part of it too. You can't condone doing that to our oceans. So that all really, really sank in when I watched the film, and that's what changed a lot for me.
You know, I had the same problem you did with fish. I think fish was one of the last things I gave up, probably even after cheese, which is
right.
a big addiction for many vegetarians, which, you know, prevents them from going all the way.
Sure.
Yeah, I agree. I was in the same boat, and then I learned boat. And then I learned a lot about how, you know, how much we waste, you know, if they're catching, you know, they're throwing away 60 to 70, sometimes 80% of the fish that they catch. And we have people starving to death around the world. It's a terrible way to try to run a business and, you know, manage our, as people would say, resources, even if they think they could eat fish. It's just a terrible business. But, you know, switching gears and going back to your situation, or not situation, but how you met your husband. And I'm curious now with, you know, Valentine's Day and February being a big month for the topic of love. What do you think, what was your initial response to his veganism? And do you have any suggestions for people who may be our listeners who are in relationships where one of the partners is vegan and one isn't?
Yeah, absolutely. This is actually one of my favorite topics because it is such an incredible story, I think, because, you know, like I mentioned, he had already been a very long time vegan. And he was, you know, he had been vegan so long, he was used to, you know, for the longest time, he didn't have any vegan friends. He didn't even know any other vegans.
Wow.
You know, so he was totally the odd one. So it was a lot easier for him to, you know, to just assume a partner or people he meet are not vegan.
Right.
So he was okay with that. And then when we first met, I remember our first date, we met at a restaurant. We sat down. We were looking at the menus. And he looks at me and he says, "Oh, by the way, I'm vegan." And I thought, totally honest, I thought, "Oh, no." And it was completely a knee-jerk reaction. But, you know, at the time, I really loved, like, you know, checking out new restaurants and going out to eat. And, you know, I really considered myself like a foodie. And, I thought like, oh, okay, this is going to be difficult. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want it to be difficult. I want us to go out and order food and share it and have the same taste. But, you know, fortunately, we were compatible in so many other ways, and it just clicked. And it honestly was not an issue for either of us. For, you know, we would still go out to eat at restaurants, and he was fine if I ordered something else. He was never, ever judgmental about it. And that's what I really like to stress to other vegans, you know, especially here in New York City. We know, you know, we're very involved in the vegan community, and there is a very young vegan crowd, you know, who are still dating and, you know, looking for vegan partners. And I've heard so many younger people say things like, "Oh, I would never date anybody who's not vegan."
Yeah.
Or "Oh, I would never kiss somebody who wasn't vegan."
I'm of that club myself.
I just want to say to all of these people, don't close yourself off to love.
Yeah.
Don't close yourself off to the possibility of finding love with somebody, because I wasn't vegan and he was open enough to accept me as I was and not try to change me. And now, years later, look, I'm vegan. I've published a vegan cookbook. We have two beautiful vegan children.
That's true.
And, you know, and if he'd been, you know, closed off to dating or even, you know, meeting somebody who wasn't vegan, then, you know, that'd be probably three less vegans in the world.
That's true.
That's right.
You know, there's also a group of people. I met one once. She felt it was her duty to move around and date other guys and convert them to veganism. Matter of fact, I was in a short relationship with her. And we were both vegan, and she left me because it was time for her to find a non-vegan male to date and change.
Oh, no. Well, I am against going into a relationship trying to change the other person. I'm very, very much against trying to change anybody else.
Well, yeah.
I think the best way, you know, as my husband Anthony did, was just to live by example, like live your life as, you know, as vegan. Show people it's delicious, it's healthy. I mean, he's super healthy. He's my husband's 50, and he, you know, can run, you know, half marathons, and he's training for a full marathon, and he bikes to work every day. I mean, you know, he's a great example of what veganism, you know, should be. So
right.
That really resonated with me.
And it's that gentle approach that works much better than being a pushy vegan. I'm surprised, though, that he didn't cook, because that's an important thing, too, is you, if you're vegan, you should know how to cook.
Or you just know how to run the drive-thrus like I do, in a way that you can find the two vegan items at Taco Bell.
You know, my husband, he's a snacker. I think he just got by all those years without really cooking much, but just kind of snacking, salads and chips and salsa and things like that.
Doesn't sound like a balanced vegan diet to me.
No. Well, I mean, he eats plenty of fruits and vegetables and stuff, but he's not in there whipping up new recipes.
Well, speaking of recipes, your cookbook is called Bacon-ish.
Yes.
And I think people would be surprised to know, a lot of people are surprised to know that there is a vegan bacon option and also a vegan incredibly tasting bacon option. Maybe you can tell us a little bit more about your cookbook and what inspired you to write it and also focus on bacon.
Yeah, sure. So, yes, my book, Bacon-ish. I'd like to say it was really inspired several years ago. We took a weekend, long weekend trip up to Montreal. And, we ate at a lot of places up there. And we ate one day at a little cafe called Au Vivre. It's a very popular vegan spot in Montreal, if you've ever been there. And they had a coconut bacon sandwich on their menu. And it was the first time I had ever heard of coconut bacon, and I was immediately intrigued, and I thought, like, I have to order that. I have to taste what that is. And it totally blew my mind. It was, like, crispy and crunchy, and it had been so many years since I'd had real bacon, but it was exactly like what I remembered, you know, like the taste and even like the crispy mouth feel. It was so uncanny.
Mm-hmm.
And
wow.
I came back raving about this coconut bacon experience I'd had. And, I had my blog already, Vegan Good Things, at the time, and I came back after that trip and I posted a recipe for coconut bacon on my blog, and it was super popular. I think probably to this day it's probably my most read blog post. And it just really sort of took off, and you know, other people were going crazy about coconut bacon too. And then after that I just started seeing more and more vegan bacon recipes popping up. I mean, we'd already had, like, you know, tempeh bacon, but then you were seeing, like, really creative things like, you know, eggplant bacon.
That's my favorite. Yeah.
Bacon. Yeah, the eggplant bacon.
Mm, yeah.
And you know, at first I had this idea that, you know, almost as a joke to just put together a book of all these vegan bacon recipes, just because it was so funny that, like, to show, like, even vegans love bacon, and, you know, even vegans can't get enough bacon, you know.
I don't understand the bacon fad. I think it's a conspiracy that was made up by hog farmers.
Well, there are definitely, physiological reasons why people like the taste of bacon.
Grease and salt.
The molecular components, yeah. It's
yeah.
like the umami flavor grease and the salt. It really hits all the, you know, your taste buds. There is a reason why those flavors and the fattiness of it appeals to people. But I started thinking sort of like about the bacon craze and like the vegan bacon craze and like that larger picture I wanted to show people that you can still enjoy all those bacon flavors and still like satisfy all those cravings, but using plant-based ingredients, so that, you know, it's so much healthier for you, and obviously it's much healthier for the pigs to eat eat vegan bacon. And so then, when I kind of thought about it in the larger picture, I thought, like, no, this is actually a project I really want to make happen. You know, I really want to do it because, you know, I think it had the potential to reach a larger audience, like the larger bacon-loving audience who might just be looking for even more bacon recipes to try. And, you know, maybe their doctors had told them to lay off the bacon or lay off the meat, and, like, they're looking for alternatives.
Right.
You know, and then it could, like, expand their minds as well. With plant, you know, using plant-based ingredients. So
beyond bacon, I think it's not a vegan diet that's restrictive. It's actually the carnivorous diet that only has chickens, pigs, and cows on the plate with a few sides of vegetables. Since I went vegetarian and vegan, I've discovered so many vegetables, you know, that I've and dishes that, you know, I never would have known of.
Right. But I got to say, looking at, you know, some of the recipes in there blows my mind a little bit. The maple bacon donuts, like BLT. I mean, obviously, BLTs. I used to love BLTs.
Me too.
That was one of my favorite things.
Right.
Bacon stuffed French toast. All this stuff, you know, really sounds outstanding. What's your favorite recipe if we have to put you on the spot?
Oh, my goodness. My favorite. That's so hard to say. But I will say the coconut bacon recipe and the coconut bacon BLT are really, you know, they really probably are my favorite. They're the dearest to my heart because they sort of started the whole thing. And I still am amazed by that coconut bacon, no matter how many times I eat it. It's just like the perfect, because, you know, the coconut has that natural fattiness to it.
Yeah, right.
And it crisps up so well, and it absorbs the marinade so well. So it really is that perfect smoky, salty, crispiness. Yeah. And I think, like, you know, if anybody is skeptical of vegan bacon, if they just try the coconut bacon, like, it will blow their mind.
Yeah, I think for sure we'll try it here. And I'd like to. They had a bacon fest locally here recently, and I thought how fun it would be to enter, you know, a vegan bacon booth and see how that went over. So I think this might be a perfect recipe for that. Our conversation has really flown by, but, you know, you do a lot of other great things, including your blog, which is Vegan Good Things. But I'm wondering if you could tell our listeners where they can go to learn more about the cookbook Baconish, and then also, you know, read your blog for Vegan Good Things.
Sure. It's my cookbook, Baconish. It's available on, you know, Amazon or in bookstores, all the normal places that books are sold. My blog is Vegan Good Things. It's just www.vegangoodthings.com. And, you know, I'm on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook also at Vegan Good Things. I always love to meet new vegan friends, so reach out.
We've been talking with Leinana Two Moons. She's the author of the cookbook Baconish and the blog Vegan Good Things. Thanks so much for being with us, Leinana.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks. If you'd like to learn more about a plant-based diet, please visit the website of the Vegetarian Society of El Paso at vsep.org. Coming up on February 25th, the Vegetarian Society will have its winter quarterly dinner at the Country Inn and Suites on 900 Sunland Park Drive. Our guest speaker will be Jim Hicks, who's the author of the book Healthy Eating, Healthy World. If you'd like to learn more about this dinner, please go to vsep.org.
If you'd like to listen to some of the past shows of ACK Radio, you can find them at ktep.org. Just click on the Listen button. Until next time, I'm Tom Linney.
And I'm Greg Lawson.
For the animals, the earth, and a healthier humanity, thanks for listening to Animal Concerns of Texas.